I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have a really good interview with Mr. Jack Neary. Jack was a writer for Muscle Builder and Power magazine in the late 1970s. And I started bodybuilding in 1977, so I was reading a lot of Jack's articles at that time when I was 14 years old. He's a very, very good writer, kind of along the guidelines of Rick Wayne, who he was working with at the time. So we've got a really fascinating interview with Jack where he talks about working for Joe and all the people he met during that time, including, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, Mike Mentzer, Cal Scalak, Frank Zane, Robbie Robinson. So Jack's got some really great stories. You're really going to enjoy this interview. And this will be part one of our interview. We'll have part two of our interview with Jack Neary next week. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so what's going on with you guys out there in the world? Got some really good feedback from last week's interview with Phil Williams and Tony Pearson, where they talked about George Turner, the legendary gym owner from St. Louis. I hope you guys like that. Got some comments here. I'm going to read some emails and some comments that I got on my YouTube page, where it's under my name, John Hansen, and I put up the video interview from Tony and Phil. So I'll read those right now. The first comment was, I can't believe Tony Pearson is 64. The guy looks like he's in his early 40s. Yeah, I agree with that. Tony looked amazing. 64 years old. He looks fantastic. Kevin said, I don't know why, but listening to these old stories makes me so happy. Greco37 says, there were George Turners everywhere back then. Barbaric owners throwing you out or squeezing your neck for past dues, banging weights, etc. Great stories, though. Keep them coming. Stephen Roberts said, damn, Tony still looks young. I always loved Tony's physique and personality. It would have been nice to hear Tony have a chance to speak a bit more. Yeah, Phil had some great stories, so he couldn't stop talking. Danny Wallace said, I trained at Turner's Gym for years, Clayton and Delwood in the 70s and 80s. I have great stories, too. Ronan says, another brilliant one, guys. I love these interviews with multiple guests. John, you always get guys who gel great together. Len Hayden said, great interview again. Phil is hilarious with a great memory for detail. And Tony is just a legend. He still looks great. I could listen to them talk all day. Beach Life said, I appreciate the content, John. I was lucky enough to have experienced 90s era bodybuilding, but I would have much rather been around in the 70s and 80s. I grew up collecting the magazines. I'm 43 now and I miss it. Thanks for keeping the golden era alive. Robert Damaris said, great video. Yeah, I've been lifting the weights since 78, right when Tony said bodybuilding was really becoming popular. The magazines just built the excitement back then. You would look forward to and be excited reading the articles on the bodybuilders, nutrition, workouts, supplements, etc. Nowadays, who really gets excited and looks forward to watching something on social media? It's just not the same. I agree with that. David Norton said, oh, he was talking about my face. I got a lot of comments. I did a video interview with Dave Palumbo last week. We were talking about the 1971 Mr. Universe and NABBA Universe, the Bill Pearl one, and Arnold was supposed to compete in it. And I didn't wear a Band-Aid over my face on the skin cancer thing I got going on my face, so it looked pretty brutal. It looks like a big scab mark. And got a ton of comments on Dave Palumbo's video about my face. People thought it was acne for some reason, even though it doesn't look like it. So, yeah, somebody said something about my face. I told him it was skin cancer, and David said, sorry to hear that, John. I hope it gets better soon, and you get the all clear. My prayers are with you, bud. Gecko Linga says, Tony looks younger than in his prime. Cool in Olympia says, I love your interviews. Thanks for giving me something to watch on a snowy day in Washington State. Andrew said, Tony looks good. I know 35-year-olds who look older. Good show as always, John. Good to see you on Dave's show. Bill Bob said, great stuff. Thanks for the stories. Bodybuilding is full of characters. Alan Campbell said, oh, man, that was so funny. Thank you for the interviews. I loved it. Philip said, real class. Thanks. Craig Mayhem said, George was a madman. He trained at Powerhouse in his last years. He gave me a complex about my arms with his unsolicited but hilarious comment that my biceps were overpowering my triceps. I trained them so hard after he said that, so now they're one of my better body parts. Then we sort of became friends. I converted his tapes to digital format for him. Hell of a character. He still had the urge to throw down despite being way too old for that crap. I broke up a fight between him and a really annoying guy that also trained at the gym, who we called the missing link. Guy deserved it, but I was worried about George hurting himself by beating the guy to death. He always seemed angry, but I loved his stories, and I listened to all his advice. Dean Phillips said, great interview, man. Two of my faves growing up in the day. John's the man. Danny Wallace said, if you didn't keep one plate on the bar, you went to the machines till you were able to lift 135. That was a fact at Turner Gyms. Dark Solera said, wow, great times. Scott Milford, my friend Scott, said another great video. Thanks for the great content, as always, John. Saxo Steve said, John, this is a fantastic interview. Absolutely love hearing about how it all started for these guys. Tony and Phil seem like really nice, genuine guys, and they both possess great physiques like yourself. God bless and keep up the good work. Steve from Boston. Frank the Tank said, truly happy memories by two great champions. You don't become a bodybuilder overnight. Perseverance, passion, and belief. I was having lunch, and I was laughing so much that my semolina didn't get in properly, and I nearly died on it, LOL. Thank you, John. I also have great memories of the Mr. Universe 1996. And David Norton said, hello from England. If you don't mind me asking, what happened to your face, John? It looks like you've been in a punch-up. Great video, by the way. I love it when guys talk about the crazy characters you used to have back in the day. You don't have characters like that anymore. And then on my Facebook page, I posted the interview, and I got a few comments. Cliff Coons, who we mentioned in the video, said, John, I love this stuff. Everything they say is true. Matt Craig said, great interview. Turner's Gym is where I started. Best gym I ever trained at, and I learned so much. I remember George told a guy that was late on his membership payment he was going to repossess his muscles. Great times and memories. Darren said, I love the interview. Richard Baldwin, 1980 runner-up at the Mr. Universe, said one of the best interviews yet. Cliff Coons again said, George told Bill Pearl, who was trying to talk him into becoming a vegetarian, why would I do that? Look how small you got. He told Arnold, I guess you don't remember me now that you're a big shot. And Richard Baldwin said, I thought Vince was an asshole until I heard about George Turner. And Cliff said, Richard Baldwin, George told a guy that was going out to train at Vince's that he, George, had bigger body parts than Vince's entire body. And George said, you could tell Vince I said that. My friend Dennis Durkin said, what a great interview. I love these old stories. George Turner must have been a real hoot. Phil's a great storyteller. And man, some of that stuff was funny. Too bad George lost everything and was alone at the end of his life. And then he said, these interviews are great. And even like Tony Pearson said, these interviews are getting better and better because a lot of the older guys are starting to get older now. And some of them have even left us already. We have to enjoy them while we can, for sure. Joe Verdo said, probably my favorite Legends podcast ever. Wow. Funny, informative, and it was clear all three of you guys were having a blast throughout the interview. Nancy Williams said, awesome. That's Phil Williams' wife, by the way. Cliff Coons again said, John, I'm not sure if Phil knows that I competed around 35 times since the 81 Nationals. I left the MPC due to politics. I won my class at the AAU Universe in 93. Then I moved on to the natural world, winning the 2002 NPA Overall Masters Universe and then the 2015 Over 50 NGA Universe. Just in case he doesn't know, I don't want him to think I never went anywhere. Or I never went to Neverland. And he said, George was the best and the worst. Everyone had a love-hate relationship with George. Truth is, everyone who was around him for any length of time was better for it. George would make you love him, and then he would put a monkey wrench in the relationship if he felt you were getting too close. And he said, the teaching pro was the title of George's articles. Weider was supposed to advertise George's equipment in exchange for the articles, but Weider wouldn't put the ads in for George's equipment. That's why they had a falling out. And for people that are new to the George Turner stories, what you have to realize is that George was way older than everybody. So when he was chewing you out, it was like your father, grandfather, or an older uncle yelling at you. He had a huge psychological advantage. All right. So those are the comments that we got on last week's interview. Everybody really liked it. If you guys have any comments on any of the interviews we do, or if you have any suggestions for guests or anything, you can email me directly at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read your interview on the air. All right. You guys are going to love this interview we got coming up with Jack Neary. Speaking of interviews, I did a really good interview today with 1969 Mr. America, John DeCola, who won the IFBB America on the same night that Arnold won the 1969 IFBB Universe, and Arnold competed in his first Olympia that night. So John looks fantastic. He's 82 years old. He was born in 39, and he looks amazing. Great health. He hit a bicep shot for me like three times. He's got a great bicep. So John's got some great stories. We'll have that interview up in a couple weeks. So you guys are going to love that. What else is going on? Oh, I got news this last week. I'll be the head judge at the a natural bodybuilding show out here in Orlando on April 10th called the Gator Classic. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm planning to do some seminars in the upcoming in this upcoming year. We had a big seminar planned last year that we had to cancel from a COVID. So I'm looking forward to doing some online seminars. I'm going to have a couple of them set up. We're going to do one on natural bodybuilding, and I'm going to do another seminar on the 12-week transformation process. I've been doing these John Hansen Fitness Challenges. I started them last year. I did like three last year. And this year, we are going to do a seminar on how to change your body in 12 weeks. So check out my website, johnhansenfitness.com. If I have any seminars planned, I'm going to announce it there. If you want to get on my mailing list, just send me an email again at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will keep you guys abreast of any seminars we got coming up. So it's going to be really cool. I'm even thinking about doing a bodybuilding history seminar, because these guys that I've talked to who are going to set up the online seminars, they do a lot of classes with other people, like people who are chefs and things like that. So I was thinking about doing a bodybuilding history that would be like a 4 or 5 part series. So I don't just be like going to a classroom to learn about bodybuilding history. So yeah, check out my website, johnhansenfitness.com, or just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. I'll put you guys on the mailing list and I'll let you know all about that. All right, here's our interview with Jack Neary, one of the best writers for Muscle Builder and Power in the late 70s. And stay tuned after the interview. I'm going to read a couple of articles that Jack Neary wrote for Muscle Builder, and we're going to do that right after Jack's interview is over. All right, here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest this week, Mr. Jack Neary. And Jack used to write for the bodybuilding magazines, Muscle Builder magazine, with Joe Weider back in the day when I was growing up. So, Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, John. I'm really honored to be asked, and I think you're doing a great thing with this podcast. It's nice to capture some of the memories of the guys who lived in the golden days.
Absolutely.
So, you know, really happy to be included in that group.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you joining me. Well, Jack, let's start from the beginning. How did you get into writing? How did you get into eventually working for Joe Weider?
Well, I had taken up weight training as a teenager when I was playing high school football.
Okay.
In Calgary, Alberta, which is in the west side of Canada. And, you know, I just gravitated towards Muscle Builder and Power magazine on the newsstands. Mm-hmm. Started reading it religiously. It was captivated by the world painted by luminary writers at the time, you know, Dick Tyler, Rick Wayne, mm-hmm. Armin Tanney, Gene Mosey, all those guys. Was really caught up in that, in the scene that they recreated for me the California scene. Yeah. Of course, when you look back at what bodybuilding was then versus what it is today, you know, it didn't really enjoy the widespread popularity that it does now. Weight training was something that was kind of frowned on. Now, of course, athletes in every sport embrace weight training. Mm-hmm. You know, in those days, it was kind of on the fringe. There was a knock against it. It made you muscle bound, all of those kind of myths.
Yeah.
But it was a very small, insular world. And there was something very special about that. And I became caught up in it just reading the magazine through the Weider publications. Mm-hmm. And the other, you know, Perry Rader's Iron Man and Dan Leary's magazine and all the different mags of the day.
Yeah.
And I actually started as a sports writer on a daily newspaper in Calgary at a young age while I was still a teenager.
Oh, wow.
And so that's how I got my start. I was a kind of a reporter for covering different sports for the daily newspaper, and was training, lifting weights on my own. And, you know, was just a real fan of bodybuilding, was a huge Arnold fan. And, mm-hmm. you know, all of the guys, Sergio Leve, all Franco, all the guys of that time.
Right.
And I thought, you know what, I'd like to work for Joe. I think I could write for this guy. And so I actually put together a letter of introduction. You know, I'm just 20 years old at the time. And I included a bunch of cuttings of sports articles that I'd written from the daily newspaper. And I sent them off to Joe. And I never really expected to get a reply. Mm-hmm. And I heard after the fact that it was Rick Wayne who was working with Joe and saw these clippings. And said to Joe, wow, this kid can really write. You should bring him down for an interview to California.
Hmm.
So I was stunned. About a week later, I got a call out of the blue from Joe's secretary, a woman, a German woman named Annalisa. I'll never forget her. And she said, Mr. Weider was really impressed by your package and would like you to fly down and meet him.
Wow.
I couldn't believe this. You know, I was absolutely knocked onto my ass. You know, this was crazy. And so she made the arrangements and I flew down and I arrived at the Woodland Hills Temple there, Weider Health and Fitness. And I'm sure you've been there. And I was waiting in the lobby, very nervous, sweaty palms, the whole thing. I was going to, you know, one of the giants of the business, Joe Weider. And I, you know, if you remember the lobby, it had this kind of grand spiral staircase that swept down from the editorial offices down into the lobby. And there were these enormous, larger-than-life, full-body oil painting portraits of some of the greats of the time, Arnold, Larry Scott, and Rick Wayne.
Wow. And
it was like this pantheon of the gods I was looking up and just in total awe.
Right.
And after a short wait, Joe Weider himself came striding down this great staircase. And, of course, Joe at that time was no stranger putting himself, his own pictures, in the magazine. He loved the publicity.
Yeah.
And I had this impression of him as this very distinguished looking older guy in his mid 50s, you know, with the coiffed hair and the walrus mm-hmm. mustache. And then, of course, he opened his mouth, and that's when the first big surprise came. It was his voice.
Yeah.
It wasn't at all what I expected. He said, hello, how are you? Did you have a good trip? And it was this high-pitched, crackling sort of voice that was really kind of unnerving to listen to, not at all what I expected.
Right.
And of course, I learned later that everyone who had met Joe had a Joe Weider imitation.
Right.
Arnold had a very good one. He was very good at imitating Joe. So Joe said, would you like to go to lunch? And so we went into, he was driving a white Lincoln Continental Mark IV, a very grand car at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to this nearby restaurant. There was this really nice sunny courtyard. There was a waterfall and it was really pretty grand. And you know, I'm just some punk kid from the prairies who you know, didn't know any better.
Right.
And here I was in the mecca of bodybuilding. And Joe said, do you want some artichokes? and I said, what? And he said, do you want some artichokes? And Joe loved artichokes. And I, as I said, I'm just this kid. I'd never had an artichoke in my life, let alone heard of one. And so we had artichokes for lunch and a couple other things. And Joe asked me a bunch of questions about my work and my writing. And I guess I answered them satisfactorily. And he entertained me over lunch with stories of his growing up as this poor kid in the Jewish ghetto of Montreal. And he liked the fact that I was a fellow Canadian. I mean, I think that was a little bit of a bond there,
right.
Even though he'd been living in the States for many, many years.
Yeah.
But he would tell the stories of how he used to go down. He was very, very poor But he would go down to the old rail yard looking for scrap metal so he could make himself these makeshift barbells out of the wheels from the trains. And, you know, I can't imagine he actually lifted wheels from the trains because those are pretty heavy, but he said he did. And we went back to the office and he said, I'm going to give you a test assignment. I want you to meet Franco Colombo and do an interview with him and do a story about his shoulder training routine. So somebody drove me here. I don't know how I got there, but I got to Franco's house. It was a beautiful sunny day. It was in his backyard. He just actually qualified to become a chiropractor. So he was very, you know, proud of himself for that and was a big deal in his life.
About 76.
Would have been May of 76.
Okay.
And forgive me if I get some of the dates wrong along the way here. It's 45 years ago.
Right.
Some of the things are a little fuzzy, but I do remember certain landmark things. And so I interviewed Franco. I had a little tape recorder. I interviewed him. He was very charming, very gracious, very generous with his time. Uh-huh. I met his wife, Anita, at the time, who also was a chiropractor.
Right.
And I flew back to Calgary the next day and I worked on my story. I sent it back down to Joe and I didn't hear anything for a while. And I got a little bit worried. And I heard later that Joe really wasn't all that crazy about the story I wrote. I don't know if I just didn't like it that much or I don't know what. Rick kept bugging him, he's good. He's a good writer. You should give him a shot. Give him a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joe ended up hiring me, obviously. And I didn't even have a car in those days. And I just got my driver's license and I bought an old Volvo, a car, and I drove down from Calgary, the 1700 miles to Los Angeles and settled into this amazing new chapter in my life.
Wow.
And I really have to say, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Rick, who became a mentor for me, and we shared a tremendous passion for writers, not just bodybuilding, but for the new journalism and, great writers like Norman Mailer and Hunter S. Thompson, George Plimpton, guys like that. We were both great fans of that. And I think that formed a bond and he kind of took me under his wing and showed me the ropes. And so I settled into life down there and, and of course that opened up a whole new avenue. I mean, I joined Gold's Gym, the original one. That Joe Gold had started on Pacific Avenue, I think it was, in Venice. And although Joe didn't own the gym then, it was owned by Ken Sprague at that time. And of course, being a writer and editor for Weider opened every door you could imagine.
Yeah.
And I met all of the top stars of the day. And I was struck by just how nice and open and generous all of these guys were to me. I mean, Arnold was so charming and giving and spent a lot of time with Arnold Beacon. Quite close to him in those early days. Franco, Frank Zane, Robbie Robinson, Ken Waller, Roger Callard. Later, Lou Ferrigno came out west, Mike Mentzer, Cal Skolic, Eddie Giuliani, Danny Pitney, all the guys, I mean, it was a place that drew the big names of the time to train at Gold's. Not all of them moved there, but they would come for periods of time and train and then go back home, back east or wherever they were from.
Right.
But, as I said, no one was more generous with his time and welcoming than Arnold himself. We became quite friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I feel free to interrupt and ask questions as we go if I'm rattling on here.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the writing because that's what really got me into bodybuilding when I was a kid. I started when I was 14 in 1977. And I remember reading Rick. Rick was a fantastic writer. I remember reading your articles. And the articles were so well written. And I miss the magazines today, of course. But what I really missed was those in-depth articles that you guys wrote, and you really felt like you got to know the different personalities of these guys. And we only got to see them if we went to the contest. So I remember I went to the Mr. Olympia in 1977, and when they came out, you felt like you knew everybody, because you read all the articles and you knew all about their personalities,
Well, that's a great insight into what we were trying to do on the magazine. I mean, I was never one of those straight in nuts and bolts reporters that just gave you the facts about a training routine or the diet of a particular guy. I mean, I wanted to give you bring the reader into the behind the scenes, give you a bit of the color and the context for what the guys were thinking and feeling and heading into contests and what was going on backstage and in the hotel rooms as they prepped. And, that's something I took some pride in working on, and that kind of journalism was a little bit unusual for the time in those magazines.
Yeah.
you know, so
great,
yeah.
It's great that you were influenced by those great writers like Hunter S. Thompson and, you know, Norman Mailer and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I didn't have the lifestyle of Hunter S. Thompson, but I but I certainly admired his work, and, yeah, and I know Rip did too. And
what did you think when you met Arnold for the first time? Because you're a bodybuilding fan like all of us were.
So well, I was awestruck by Arnold. I mean, he had retired after the 75 South Africa Olympia, his fifth Olympia, and he was at such a level above everyone else. I mean, I just saw him in such awe. But he was a really nice guy. He was like a big brother, you know. He was a fun guy. He liked to play pranks. He liked to have fun. He was really a magnetic personality, and of course, he was branching out then from being just a bodybuilding guy to a young budding actor. He had just been in Stay Hungry, yeah, and Pump and Iron, of course, was coming out, and he was getting noticed beyond the bodybuilding world into the Hollywood celebrity world. Right. And I think he was interested in me because my interest in writing and literary things and that sort of thing. And he hired me to write his bodybuilding courses for his mail order courses.
Oh, wow.
So I ghost wrote and designed all of those. I mean, he had a batch before, but I don't know who wrote his first batch, but I did a whole renewal of them. It was about 10 different booklets. And of course, that was a big source of revenue for him in those days.
Yeah.
You know, the mail order ads in the back of Weider's magazine. And, you know, there were a couple of guys that did it, but Arnold was really the pioneer of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I worked on that and he really liked what I did. And I spent a lot of time art directing them. Not that I'm really a designer, but I put that effort to work and he was really happy with it. And, you know, I used to go to his house all the time. And in those days, his interest in politics, it was a fledgling budding interest. I remember one night, a Sunday evening, we watched the 76 presidential debate between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter together.
Okay.
And he was pulling for Ford. He was a young Republican in the making. Right. And, you know, and we were really caught up in it. And so I got to see a side of Arnold that a lot of, you know, fans wouldn't have got to see.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
And he was really...
That's kind of my favorite time of Arnold's life. You know, I'm a big Arnold fan. I've read a ton of books about him, a ton of biographies about him. And I really like that period in Arnold's life between when he retired from bodybuilding until he made it big in acting, which is probably like a 5-year period. And he really wasn't well known by the general public, but it seemed like, you know, when I watched interviews with him on like the Tonight Show in like 1978, 79, around that era, he's very articulate. He's very honest. It had to be a great, great period to know him in his life then, you know, before he became a really big star.
Well, you had a sense that this was a guy who was going places, you know, he wasn't going to just be a retired bodybuilder, and he really was eager to cultivate a presence in the film scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, before Conan, which was his first big break.
Right.
But he was, you know, courting interest among the press. And I'll never forget one of the greatest weeks of my life, thanks to Arnold's generosity. It coincided around the 1976 Mr. America contest. That was probably the last time they called them Mr. Contests, you know. Then they went to things like American Bodybuilding Championships and World Bodybuilding Championships, because Ben Weider wanted bodybuilding to be considered for inclusion in the Olympics, and that sounded more like a sport than a Mr., like a beauty pageant kind of attitude. So the Mr. America contest, that was the one won by Mike Mentzer in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I'd ever been to New York. I was wide-eyed with wonder at the skyscrapers and the whole scene. And Arnold and I actually shared a hotel room at Howard Johnson's in Times Square.
No kidding.
For that week. I know. I mean, he was pretty frugal in those days, as was I. And, and he was a judge at the contest. And of course, the contest was notable because it was the first time Mike Mentzer really burst onto the scene. And everybody was in awe of him, this young, amazing talent with huge arms and a little bit, not the greatest poser in the world in those days, but you know, a young star in the making. But Arnold was also, he had set up a lot of, you know, interviews with various media outlets. And I remember at the night of the contest, Arnold, even though he was a judge, he left early from the evening show because he was asked to be the date of Candace Bergen as her kind of escort to the Saturday Night Live filming. It was in the early days of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
At NBC. And so Arnold sort of took off and went with Candace for that.
Wow.
And you know, the show finished up and I interviewed Mike and a bunch of the other guys of the time, and can't remember all the guys who did well in the various classes, but it was a great show.
Yeah.
And I was back at the hotel room. I was, you know, it was like midnight and I'm sitting in bed reading, and suddenly the phone rings and it's, "What are you doing?" It's Arnold. And he says, "You want to come to an after party and get dressed and come down now." And so I got dressed. I had just blue jeans and a t-shirt. You know, I was way underdressed. And I went to this really swanky club called Park Avenue 1/5, which was kind of done up like an old Titanic ocean liner.
Oh,
and it had, like, you had to open a porthole to get in. Like, you know, they had to look at you through a porthole to let you in. And I knocked on the door and they said, "Who are?" I said, "I'm a guest of Arnold Schwarzenegger." And I was going, "They probably don't know who this guy is." And they know, "Oh yeah, Arnold. And, you know, and suddenly Arnold was at the door and he ushered me in. And the first guy I met was Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
And when he heard that I worked for Weider's magazine, like, he was into fitness and he was into vitamins and nutrition and all of that stuff. He bored the tears off me. Like, I couldn't get rid of the guy. He was going on and on for half an hour. Wow. He said, "I got these terrible calcium deposits on my fingers because it affected his guitar playing." And he said, "What do I take? What do I take? Inositol or choline? Or what do I take for these calcium deposits?" Because I didn't have the slightest idea, but I would sort of bluff my way along with it.
Right.
And we had this half hour conversation, and then Arnold says, "Come and sit at the table." And it was just madness. It was just, everyone was drunk and crazy. And there was this giant table, a round table. And I'm sitting there and there's Arnold on one side of me, and I sense a presence on my right side. And this guy turns to me and says, "Oh, hello, Jack, how are you?" And it's Jack Nicholson.
No.
And yeah, there's Jack Nicholson sitting there, and he goes, "Oh, my name's Jack too." And I said, "Yeah, I know." And he said, "Tell me, Jack, what have you been up to this summer?" And I said, "Oh, well, I've just moved down from Canada and I'm working at the Weider magazine," explaining, you know, of course, wasn't impressed in the least by that. And I said, "What have you been doing this summer, Jack?" And he says, "I've been sitting on the back of a yacht reading scripts in the Mediterranean." And I said, "Oh, well, that's a summer." And then he said, "Have you met Mick?" And I stand up and Mick Jagger is across the table.
Oh, man, unbelievable.
He is absolutely shit-faced, pardon my language, legless, like he's just hammered. He could barely stand. He kind of extends his hand, and he's wearing this robin's egg blue blazer, very striking jacket. I'll never forget it. And I shake his hand, and I met Keith Richards, and, you know, all the Rolling Stones were there. And, the night unfolded from there. It was just madness.
Was John you there and the guys from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. And, you know, it was the very early cast, John Belushi when he was still alive. And, of course, it was the night on Saturday Night Live that Joe Cocker had been the musical guest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And John Belushi did a great imitation
of Joe Cocker. Right.
Yeah. So that was pretty, it was a pretty special moment for me, you know, just to be eyewitness to that. And on that same trip, we had lunch. Arnold, we went to Elaine's, which was a very popular Upper East Side salon, you know, restaurant where a lot of celebrities would go, Woody Allen, guys like that.
Right.
We met Dustin Hoffman and Robert Towne, who wrote the screenplay for Chinatown, guys like that.
Right.
And we met Andy Warhol, you know, the great pop artist.
Right.
And Andy invited Arnold, "Oh, you should come to the factory and do a lunch with us and do an interview for Interview Magazine." And Arnold didn't really know who Andy Warhol was.
Hmm.
And he asked me later, he said, "You know, who is this Andy guy? He seems kind of weird. What should I go and meet him? Should I meet him?" And I said, "Yeah, you're damn right. You should meet him. I mean, he's a legendary artist. He's a cultural icon."
Right.
And I said, "Interview Magazine is also very influential for celebrity culture."
Yeah.
So the next day, Arnold and I went together to the factory near Union Square in New York. And I'll never forget that we walk into the lobby of the offices there, and there's a Great Dane stuffed like a taxidermy, like a Great Dane, you know, just there. It's just something you don't see every day. And we were ushered into this boardroom, and there was an enormous moose head, like another stuffed animal, a moose head at the head of the table where Andy sat. And they did this box lunch, the best sandwiches I've ever had, tuna sandwiches. and in boxes. And Andy, who hardly said two words, like his editor, Bob Gucci, not Guccione, Bob Policello, did most of the questions for the interview. And Arnold was very charming, and everyone really took Arnold because he had such a magnetic personality.
Right.
And then after the interview, Andy himself took Arnold and I behind the scenes to the factory where he makes all his famous silkscreen paintings, you know, various celebrities and stuff that are worth millions today. And, you know, he showed us the process, which I found really interesting. And, you know, that was another great glimpse into a world that I never would have had access to if it wasn't for Arnold's kindness, you know, instead of including me in all of that.
Right, right. Wow. Amazing.
I also met Douglas Kent Hall on that trip, who wrote Arnold's first book, the biography of Arnold, The Education of a Bodybuilder. I'm sure you read it as a kid. And Douglas was a wonderful guy. He was very big in the rodeo world, had written books about rodeo, culture. And, and he and I hit it off, and I used to see him at the occasional concert contests after that. Lovely man, lovely guy.
Wow, what an amazing week. That's great. You'll never forget that week for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I really will. It's crazy.
Yeah, unbelievable. So what was the first big show you went to, Jack? Was it that 76 America, that one you're talking about?
Yeah, I it was either that. Actually, the first big show I went to, it was in Vancouver, Canada. I was down in Los Angeles then. It was in July, really the first month or so of me being down there.
Okay.
And Arnold was a guest poser. He wasn't in great shape, but it was at the Mr. North America. And I can't remember who won it. Like Darcy Beckles was in it, and a couple guys. And Joe flew me up for that. And Arnold and I, that's when I really got to know Arnold. We went to a party and got into all kinds of trouble and had some fun and everything. But that was one of the first contests. But I guess the first really major contest was the America. Mm-hmm. That mentor one. And of course, Mike and I went on to become really good friends after that over the years.
I remember that.
You know, we can get into Mike a little bit later, but that was probably the first big contest. The first contest that really blew me away for the scale of it and the drama and the noise and was the 76 Olympia.
Okay.
In Columbus, Ohio, the one that Franco won, his first. It was the first time that Arnold and Jim Lorimer, his co-promoter, staged in Columbus. They went on to do a number of those, of course. Jim Lorimer was a wonderful man, like a very prominent business leader in Columbus, and just a really lovely guy. He had us into his home and really generous with his time. And it was Arnold's first kind of foray into promoting. And of course, you know, he's turned that into a huge enterprise now. But I was just blown away by it. I mean, the moment that just shook me was so dramatic was Ed Corney's performance. Ed didn't have the greatest, he had a fantastic physique. I mean, I think his physique was overlooked how good it was because he was such a stellar poser. I mean, he just brought the house down. I mean, the whole place shook. I thought the balcony was going to collapse. Wow, it was that loud. Crazy. And Franco won, and Frank Zane, of course, was there, and Ken Waller, and, you know, a lot of the guys of the time. It was really, I'd never seen anything on that scale.
Wow.
Really dramatic.
Just the way it was staged and just the atmosphere and everything, right?
And it just the noise of the fans. I mean, I tell you, you know, as I said, bodybuilding those days was a smaller world, but boy, were the fans into it. I mean,
right.
You know, there's nothing, you know, once you get bitten by the iron bug, you become such a zealot. And it's exhibited by the vocal nature of the fans in ways that football or baseball or basketball fans don't. And there's just something special about a big bodybuilding crowd.
I talked to Roger Schwab, and Roger was a judge back then. And he made a point. He said that the bodybuilding audiences back then were very knowledgeable and they really knew their sport. And, you know, they were very passionate about it. And I went to my first Olympia was the year after that one in 77. So I know what you mean about the noise. It was just incredible. It was amazing. It was just, the people were standing on their feet screaming. You don't see anything like that today. It's just, it was a special world back then.
Yeah. Now I haven't really been to a contest in many years, so I don't know what it's like today. Of course, with the pandemic, it's compromised everything, but we'll get back to a normal life soon enough.
Yeah.
But are the fans as equally as enthusiastic now? No, not at all.
I mean, not at all. You don't see that kind of pandemonium anymore. And now they have all these different divisions, too. So it's kind of watered down. You know, you've got bikini, you've got fitness, you've got men's physique, and it's just, it's a marathon show. You know, it's not, back then we just had men's bodybuilding and that was it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, it, as both of us had grown up reading the magazine, I remember reading about when it was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music for Larry Scott's 1965, when the first Olympia, and just how mad that was. The crowd was insane.
Yeah.
I never quite understood what the reports meant until I saw the 76 Olympia. And I said, oh, now I know what they mean.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So what was it like? Tell me a little bit more about hanging out with Arnold, because he's such an icon now. And he's, you know, is one of the world's biggest movie stars ever. But you knew him before all that. I heard it.
I'll relay one story I remember vividly. I don't know if this will get me in trouble or not for telling it, but, you know, here goes. On that trip to Vancouver for the Mr. North America, Arnold and I had been at a party the night before, and we were flying out on the Sunday morning back to Los Angeles from Vancouver. And I don't know why, but Arnold had my airplane ticket. He was wearing a blazer, a navy blazer for the flight. And he had my airplane ticket, my return ticket, in his breast pocket. And we were seatmates, and we flew from Vancouver to, in those days, he had to stop off in San Francisco and change planes and carry on the rest of the way for the last leg. And somehow Arnold and I got separated in the airport, and he had my return ticket for the last leg in his pocket.
Okay.
And I couldn't get on the plane. I had nothing. I didn't have even a credit card in those days. You know,
I'm
21 years old. I had a couple of quarters in my pocket, and Arnold takes off on the plane without me with my ticket. I have no way of getting back home to Los Angeles.
And
I had parked my car in front of his house a couple of days before that. And we drove together to the airport to LAX. So I needed to get to his place and get to my car and get home and then report to work the next day at Weider. And, you know, so I said, oh, God. So Arnold's got my plane ticket. I went to it was PSA Airlines. It used to exist in those days. And I went up to the desk and I said, look, you know, my friend Arnold, they didn't have any idea who Arnold was. And I said, you've got my ticket. I have no way of getting back. Is there, you know, I don't know. I was trying to find a way to get onto a plane. And of course, I had no cash. And Arnold, his routine in those days was he would go to the Venice Beach on Sunday afternoons.
Okay.
And sort of suntan and hang out with the guys and gossip and just sort of be, you know, just the guys getting together on the beach. It was a big deal and part of bodybuilding culture at that time. And so Arnold went from landing at the airport to LA straight to the beach. He never went home. And I'm calling his house. I got my one quarter and I'm calling his house. And I keep getting his mother. His mother was visiting from Austria. She didn't speak any English. And I didn't speak any German. And I'm trying to communicate with her. Where's Arnold? Where's Arnold? And I'd met her actually a few days before. And I don't know if she knew who I was, but I was trying to acquaint her, you know, I don't know if you remember me kind of thing, but, you know, so that didn't go very far. And then I figured out he must have gone to the beach. And there was this course, this is before cell phones,
right?
Way before, you know, and, you know, it was pay phones in those days.
Right.
So I'm hanging out in the San Francisco airport for hours on end. I'm being harassed by Hare Krishnas and, you know, just, you know, the whole thing. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And I finally, about 6 o'clock that evening, Arnold comes home from the beach and I get him at home. He said, where are you? What's that? You know, like, it's my fault. He started yelling at me, like, where was I? You know, I said, you've got my ticket, you know? And I said, is there any way you can get to the airport or call the airline and wire another ticket to, you know, get me on the next plane? So he takes care of that. And I said, also, can you pick me up? Because I didn't even have fare for the taxi to his place in Santa Monica then. And so he picks me up in his incredible car. He used to drive these big 6.9 liter engine Mercedes. It was a silver tank of a car.
Yeah.
He used to keep it immaculate. And Arnold picked me up. It's like 8:30 at night, just dark out. And he's got a friend with him. Bernd Zimmermann was his name. He was a guy who ran a chain of health studios in Austria and Germany. I was a karate guy. and really nice guy. He looked like George Pappard, the actor. And he was in the A-team. And so Arnold was driving. Barrett was in the front right passenger seat. I'm sitting directly behind Arnold. And we're starting to drive towards Marina Del Rey. And running along the northern boundary of LAX is an east-west road. I forget what the name of the road is that leads you into Marina Del Rey. And we're taking this road. It's a really dark. There's no other traffic around us, dead quiet. And suddenly Arnold swerves the car over to the side of the road. And he says something in German to Berndt. And they have this sort of agreement or something. And suddenly the car pulls over and Arnold opens his driver's side door. And I see that he's pulled into view a .357 Magnum pistol. You know, I go, my God, what the hell is, I thought they're going to shoot me or something. And Arnold stands up and he puts his gun out into the night sky and shoots off four rounds into the sky, like directly above, like right by the airport. He wasn't trying to hit an airplane. Let me be clear on that. He was just, I think he had just bought this new gun and he was like a kid. He really wanted to let it go. And so he fires the gun and I see these giants, like a cannon going off, these giant sparks shooting up into the night sky. And I'm thinking, my God, and Barrett's laughing and Arnold's laughing. And suddenly he gets in and puts hides the gun under his seat and zooms off like a getaway. And we go home. And that was the end of that night. You know? I've told that story to friends and no one's ever believed me. And I hope Arnold doesn't sue me for that, but it's the God's truth. That's what I witnessed it with my own eyes.
Oh, that's crazy.
But that's the kind of guy he was. He was a prankster. He liked to have a good time.
Right. He had to be so much fun to hang out with. And you spent the whole time with him in that hotel room. That would be crazy.
Oh, yeah. He was great.
Wow. Did he ever hook up with Candace Bergen, or was that just like a publicity stunt date thing?
I'm not aware of any romance that came from that. They had the one date. I mean, I'm sure they maintained a friendship, but it was, you know, a couple of years later that Maria Shriver kind of became the great love interest in Arnold's life.
Yeah.
A lovely, gracious woman who I'd met a couple of times. And, you know, Arnold was very just enthralled by her. And, she was a beautiful woman, but also she represented a political dynasty in the Kennedys. And I think Arnold was hugely interested in all of that because he harbored political ambitions, although he never necessarily articulated them then. You could tell that was something that he was kind of, you know, getting into the lane to follow toward.
I remember he did an interview, I think it was in 1979, and the reporter said that Arnold said his ideal woman was Candace Bergen because she was beautiful, she was smart, you know, she had a great personality, and that's all the qualities he was looking for in a woman.
Yeah. She was really a lovely woman.
Yeah.
So he never really talked about her too much to me after that, but I never saw her at the after party. So maybe she got tired of being with Arnold and took off. I don't know, but there was a lot of other big names there that night.
Oh yeah. Wow. Amazing. So tell me a little bit about Mike Mentzer, because you met him in 1976 when he won the America, and you said that was the year he kind of came out, and then he was the big bodybuilding hit. And then he of course became very famous because he was talking about the low volume type of training that he did, which nobody else was doing at the time. So you developed a friendship with Mike, huh?
Yeah. Mike, we actually shared an apartment for a short time together.
Oh, really?
Betty Weider, Joe's wife, had a very old aunt. Ann Brosmer was her name. Lovely old woman who had a small scale apartment complex on Beverly Glen in West Los Angeles. And a couple of the apartments in the back, like Ann lived in the front unit and there were three other units behind. And I used to rent one of them from her. Joe kind of found digs for me in those days. And he put up Mike and Kathy Gelfo, his girlfriend at the time, there. And I actually was out of a home for a short time, ended up staying with them for a few weeks and got to know them really well. And of course, I became a huge fan of Mike and, became a devotee of the high, you know, heavy duty, high intensity training, which, of course, is the antithesis of the kind of training I was writing about in Arnold's bodybuilding courses, you know, many, many sets, lots of reps, hours of training in the gym each day. And I ended up, just as an aside, I ended up writing quite a few other bodybuilders, mail order courses for them as a ghostwriter, like Roger Callard. Robbie Robinson, Pete Grimkowski, Bill Grant, guys like that. Okay. They would hire me to write that stuff. And they all basically did the same thing, you know. Yeah. And then along came Mike, who kind of came from the school of Nautilus, Arthur Jones, mm-hmm. who Mike used to rave about as a genius, a really like an interesting guy. And, you know, it made a lot of sense what Mike talked about. But of course, it ruffled a lot of feathers, you know, because basically Mike wasn't afraid of voicing his opinion. You know, he would say, you know, the kind of training Arnold and guys like that are doing is counterproductive. It's a waste of time, and you could do so much more with less. And of course, Mike spawned a huge following. Guys like Dorian Yates followed in his footsteps, and Casey Viator, guys like that, who was an Arthur Jones guy as well. And I helped Mike a little bit. Mike was a pretty good writer in his own stead. Like he mm-hmm. actually wrote all his articles for Weider. Whereas what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the articles written in Joe's magazines that were under the byline of a bodybuilder were actually written by one of us. You know, Armin Tanney used to write a lot of the articles for Joe as a, you know, name your bodybuilder, you know. But Mike would write his own articles. He was one of the few, Rick Wayne also being an exception. And so, you know, Mike ended up moving out west to Los Angeles, and we became very good friends. I also, you know, it's funny because the nature of the writing I like to do, which is getting behind the scenes and into the personalities of the guys versus just the mechanical nuts and bolts. I, in some ways, one of my regrets years later, looking back, is I almost became too close to some of the bodybuilders. And I think in some ways it kind of hampered my journalistic integrity and my neutrality, which is something you really have to watch. And I became really caught up in the Mensur scene and was really, you know, enthralled. In fact, I remember at the 1977 World Championships, which were in the south of France, Nîmes, France.
Right.
Everyone was touting Mike to be the big winner, and I was certain he was going to win. Everyone was certain he was going to win.
Right.
But along came this guy, Cal Skolic,
right,
who was phenomenal. And I met Cal. He had just come out from, I think, Delaware or Rhode Island, one of those smaller states on the East Coast, and lived out west. And I got to know him a little bit interviewing him, and Joe liked him. And but Cal came in and just blew Mike away that day. Mm-hmm. Mike's timing was off. He wasn't in the best shape. And Cal, of course, you know, Cal did a lot with, he didn't have the greatest legs, the greatest calves, but he had such phenomenal arms and chest that it would overpower everyone else. And, right. And it was a real shocker. And I remember thinking, man, I didn't see that coming, and I should have.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one of my regrets years later, that I don't regret the friendship that I had with Mike Mensur. He was a really dear and lovely man.
Yeah.
But I feel in some ways it compromised my reporting a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Did you write the article differently when you covered it, Jack? 4 months or more than Cal?
No, I remember Cal telling me he was really happy with the article, the report I did, and how fair and balanced it was. So I tried to be balanced, but sometimes I would find myself falling into the fan club of a particular guy.
Yeah.
I was really close with Robbie Robinson as well. He was a wonderful guy. I used to spend a lot of time with him. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you one story your listeners may want to hear about. I witnessed the famous Cal Skolic incident with Joe Weider.
Oh, yeah.
Where they butted heads.
Okay.
It was a crazy moment. I can't remember if this, well, I guess this would have been after the 77 universe, you know, world championships. Cal had won it.
I was going to ask if it was before the 78 Olympia when he did the crucifix.
Yeah, the famous crucifix. Yeah. Well, it was just leading up to the 78 Olympia.
Okay.
And, you know, Cal, he was a really nice guy, had a lovely wife who was from the Dutch Indonesian islands, Malacca.
Right.
Really lovely guy, really strong. And I interviewed him a number of times. We became pretty friendly. But Cal was a very straight, real straight shooter. He's kind of a no-nonsense straight shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Was very honest, very unvarnished. And, you know, Joe was a guy, Joe liked to be liked. And Joe would like to make promises he never tended to keep. Mm-hmm. You know, he, in fact, he even told me, and I was nothing in terms of like being a bodybuilder. I mean, I used to train as a power lifter. I was really into lifting, but was never anything to write home about. Mm-hmm. But Joe would say, yeah, if you keep up the training, I'm going to give you $50,000 and put you on the cover of the magazine. and I think, and he's saying this to me, you know, and I go, come on, Joe. So, you know, he would make promises, and I guess he'd made a few promises to Cal that were not, as far as Cal was concerned, were not coming true. I don't know what they were, and I wasn't privy to those conversations. But I think Cal's nose was out of joint because, you know, I think he felt like Joe was saying all this stuff and the stuff wasn't forthcoming, whatever that was.
Yeah.
And I remember it was in the winter. It was a rainy day. It was quite quiet. Joe had a couple offices in the editorial part of the Weider and Health and Fitness building. He had his big office. It was all mahogany paneled in a huge boardroom. And those places were like the inner sanctum. They were like museums. He would have all this artwork, and he had one of the first revolutionary flags of the American Revolution framed. You know, it's a priceless artifact.
Yeah.
He had beautiful Frederick Remington bronze statues of Western life, like the cowboys and Indians and all that, and buffalo and all that kind of stuff.
Right,
that's worth a fortune. But where Joe spent most of his time was at a little table in the center of the art studio, in the design studio, where the art directors would work in terms of putting together the magazine every month. You know, these are the art directors that designed the pages and laid out the photographs and all that stuff, you know, kind of the nerve center mm-hmm. of the operation. And Joe used to sit there and hold court, and he used to put a loop in his eye and he'd look at these contact sheets. This is the days before digital, of course. And he would look at negatives, and I'll say one thing about Joe. He wasn't just a great bodybuilding fan. He was a great publisher. He really loved publishing, and he knew it. And he knew how to turn out a good magazine. He always made a good product, and he had many years of that under his belt. And he had a good eye for good photography, and used to drive Artie Zeller nuts and guys like that. But he would circle on the contacts and the negatives. This is a good one. Crop it here, crop it there. He would direct the art directors on how to make the stuff look even better. And so Joe would spend a lot of time sitting there in the kind of the nerve center in full view of everyone. It was all these glass enclosed offices. And, you know, Cal came in through the back door. Someone coming in from the street would come in through the front reception, let the receptionist know, I'm here to see Mr. Weider, et cetera. But Cal knew there was a side door that led into the warehouse. Mm-hmm. And then there was a big metal staircase that went up into the back side of the editorial offices. So he could come in and bypass the reception. So one day, Cal Skolnick, he's wearing an Adidas tracksuit, you know, zip top suit. And he comes storming in, and he's got a head. He's red faced and angry. And he's sort of yelling at Joe. They had a few words like you're not keeping your promises, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm there with Joe. I'm witnessing this whole thing. And then Cal made a beeline into this little room adjacent, which was the photo library. And it wasn't a very sophisticated place. It was just a bunch of filing cabinets stuffed with prints of photos that had run in Joe's magazines over the years. And they were all broken down by bodybuilder alphabetically.
Okay.
And so Cal scoops up all the S's, like his stuff, as well as all the Arnold photos and a bunch of other guys, the Zane photos and the Rick Wayne photos. And he's got just armfuls of photos. Like, I'm talking about thousands of photos in his arms, bursting out. And he comes running back through the studio to make a getaway. And Joe says, you're not getting away with those. And Joe, I got to give Joe credit. You know, he was a 57-year-old guy. He lifted weights a bit, but he was nothing like Cal Skolnick in terms of formidable physique.
Right.
And he stood right there and stood his ground. And Cal ran into him like a rhino charging and just, bam, hit him, like sent Joe flying, sent a bunch of the photos flying across the room. But Cal quickly scooped up the ones on the floor, and he grabbed me his armfuls and then went down the back stairs again and got in his car and zoomed it off.
Wow.
And he made off with all these photos, like, I'm taking them.
Wow.
And of course, Joe was apoplectic. He was beside himself. you know, like call the cops, this is robbery, you know, the whole thing, you know, quite dramatic.
Right.
And of course, Joe had his lawyers and there was lawyers involved. And a few days go by and kind of heads cool. And I got word from Cal, you can meet me in the parking lot of the Santa Monica airport and I'll hand over the photos to you. And so I drive my old Volvo over there. He's got his Camaro or whatever he was driving then. And it was like this like clandestine drug deal. Right. You know, he hands over these photos to me and they're all bent and wrinkled and stuff from the violence. And I take them back to Joe the next day and they pursued a lawsuit. I never quite knew how it was resolved, but I think Joe ended up having to pay Cal some money and to make him go away. But yeah, that was a pretty memorable day, I must say.
Yeah, I always heard rumors about that story, but I never talked to anybody who was there. So that's awesome. That's
great. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Jack Neary for joining us for that great interview. We will, of course, have part two of our interview with Jack next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And thank you also to our Patreon sponsors. I thank you guys every week. I can't thank you enough for helping to support the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. If anyone's interested in helping to support the show, you can do so by going to the official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link for Patreon. And just click on that, and you can donate as little as $5 a month if you wish. It really helps to pay the bills and keep the website going or keep the podcast going. So I appreciate you guys. And I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, before we go, I want to read a couple articles from Jack Neary. Actually, one of them is from Rick Wayne, and I believe this was in the September 1978 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. So I've got two articles. Let me read the first one. This was about the 1978 World Cup, which was held in July. It was a Gold's Gym-sponsored contest, and Robbie Robinson took first place, Danny Padilla looking awesome in his first year as a pro. He got second place, and Roy Callender, also looking awesome, he got third place. All right, the article is called Santa Wore a Robbie Robinson T-shirt by Rick Wayne. So Christmas arrived in July for Robbie Robinson, last September's Wednesday's child, whose personal woes would, for no less than half a year, oil the collective savage animosity of every aspiring dunce this side of Norman Mailer, has put his critics out to pasture, retired them to whatever nowhere land grazing grounds have been reserved specially for the walking dead apostles of I Told You So. Yes, having completely devastated the geriatric ambitions of Ed Corney and Boyer Coe, Dennis Tinerino too, having put Billy Grant in his place a million light years from Roy Callender, the rest never really had a chance against the mentioned formidable four. 3 months earlier in New York, the night of the champions, Muscle Builder, July 1978, the Black Prince came out in full shining armor on July 29th, ready to once again take care of business, a raging, ripped-up inferno of undisguised bodybuilding ambition. Truly, the brothers had never had it so good, not for 8 years, not since Sergio Oliva, may the gods be merciful and restore him, took up semi-permanent residence above the Mr. Olympia sky. They'll take one look at me and they'll know who really is boss on this glory train, he said earlier. They, meaning the judges, official and self-proclaimed, and World Cup contenders both. But let none of this suggest it was easy meat taking the number one spot in the AAU IFBB-sponsored World Cup competition. No, for indeed, Robbie Robinson would encounter innumerable stations of the cross in his quest for reinstatement as bodybuilding's number one son. There was Roy Callender, for one. Some 90 days earlier, on May 6, Robbie and Roy battled in Wayne D'Amelia Charles Blake's Night of the Champions promotion. There was many who felt Roy would be unbeatable once he had shed the 5 or 8 pounds of subcutaneous fat that stood between him and the number one spot in New York. Roy himself had admitted he was not quite ready on the big night. It seems he had agreed to appear in the D'Amelia Blake extravaganza with only 5 days' notice. He knew he was not quite contest ready. And by implication, he had promised to be fully prepared to knock Robbie's ambitions flat on their teeth on July 29th. Then there was Danny Padilla, who, by Robbie's own account, was always extremely dangerous and should never be taken lightly. For once, Danny had made up his mind to make some real noise at a contest. Indeed, the World Cup affair was to him a mere stepping stone to the Big O. He planned to leave no stone unturned in his determination to hit the best shape of his not at all unsuccessful bodybuilding career. Danny had quit the comforts of his New York habitat to train at Gold's in Santa Monica. That itself was proof enough that he meant business. And then there was Pete Gronkowski, big as St. Paul's Cathedral, with more tracks between body parts than British railways. Pete had transformed himself from that bulky, unsuccessful Mr. America candidate into one of the most discussed subjects of bodybuilding. His drug-related pieces and muscle builder had established him as a no-nonsense straight talker. Well, now he was talking about setting up some Mr. World contenders on their behinds. Boyer Coe, still hurting from whatever happened to him on the night of the champions, was in no mood for games. He too meant business, as did Muhammad Makawe and the would-be Ali of bodybuilding, Bill Grant. Indeed, one spied Grant on Venice Beach on Memorial Day, and save for his sad trademark, he looked as his best ever shape. As usual, his confidence did not recognize limits. From the outset, the World Cup promised a hell of a night for competitors and fans. And with some $20,000 plus a brand new limousine on the line, it comes as no great surprise that by curtain time, the excitement had hit fever pitch. But we'll get to that in time. And then there was the contest that would yield the U.S. World Championships team. One had had the opportunity to observe Mike Mentzer prepare for it. Each day seemed to grow larger. This kid is a glutton for punishment, and what he put his body through each workout session would earn a man a lifetime of legal incarceration on some remote island if the body he so treated himself belonged to someone other than himself. Torture is hardly the word. Incidentally, while Mike was at his lightest for the great pose down, something around 212 compared to his regular 230 pounds, he was more cut, a situation that one strongly suspects was helped by his ever-loving Kathy. After all, he ate only what she served him. Mike has also made incredible improvements to his back, but he still had a surprise for the fans. We'll come to that also, but later. We had all expected Makawe to be his usual unbeatable self. He would face Danny Padilla one more time when the World versus USA event got underway, and this writer, for one, could hardly wait for the big day. Darcy Beckles was also scheduled to be on the world team, as were Peter Stock from Czechoslovakia, Paul Grant from Britain, Renato Bertagno from Italy, and Alois Peck from Czechoslovakia. One had the opportunity to meet and talk with Muhammad Makawe on the eve of the event. He was bigger than usual and set to blow minds, as they say. There would be some disappointed people before the weekend was out. Earl Maynard, former IFBB Mr. Universe, had always been a favorite to take the over 40 Mr. America title. He trained most of the time at Gold's, and it was hard to tell which gave him the most pleasure, the prospect of turning out number one in the contest, or the fat contract that he already had landed with a movie company scheduled to begin work in Munich come September. But Don Peters would be there too, big, symmetrical, and confident. On the Friday before the contest, I squeezed into Gold's to peep at some of the teenage Mr. America contestants. It seemed the best among them could give senior Mr. America aspirants a serious run for their money. All in all, one looked forward to the greatest bodybuilding show on earth, and in many ways, it was just that. There were joyful whoops, there were stifled tears, and some guys ended up pretty rich indeed. The pictures accompanying this piece supply a mere soup con of what really went on at the IFBB AAU event. Unfortunately, space does not allow for the exciting details. For that, you must wait until next month. Meanwhile, the results appear below. Be sure to get your copy of next month's Muscle Builder. You'll grip your chair as you read the exciting details at some of what has said outshone the Mr. Olympia contest. Read, enjoy, and make up your own mind. We'll have incredible action photos, many in color, and we'll show you a side of the big contest that you never saw before. Now, isn't all that worth waiting for? You bet it is. All right, so that was probably like a preview article for the World Cup competition. They got a great shot in here of Mike Mentzer doing one of his back poses, and he really looks awesome. Like Mike, like Rick said, he was very ripped up. We got another shot of the lineup with Pete Gronkowski and Danny Padilla, and Robbie looking incredible, and Roy Callender. And then they got a shot of Gronkowski and Boyer Coe posing. And then it looks like they got a picture of Robbie winning the title with Joe Weider presenting him a huge portrait of himself, a huge picture of himself that looks like it came from the Night of the Champions. and Roy Callender and Danny Padilla are standing on stage with them. So good article. And now I want to read one more for you guys. This is about the Mensers, the Menser brothers. And this was written by Jack Neary, who we just heard from. All right, the name of this article is Blood is Thicker Than Water, But the Rivalry Lives On by Jack Neary. When he wasn't on the road plying his trade at that big wheel of a diesel rig, Henry Menser would receive a vicarious thrill by pitting his boys, Mike and Ray, against each other in athletic feats behind their Euphrata, Pennsylvania house. Harry, a strapping man himself, would be delighted to watch his son sprint along the back alley, and it was there that a sibling rivalry, what a term for the sociology textbooks, was born. When the Menser boys were urged to don great leather boxing gloves and trade wild looping haymakers, the rivalry flourished. When Mike brought home a report card decorated with A's and Ray failed the grade, the rivalry was consummated, giving way to a damaging inferiority complex for Ray that only now is being soothed with the salve of maturity. Right from the start, our father instilled the masculine qualities of competition in us, reminisced Ray in an interview. Mike was leading more of a passive, laid-back life in grade school. I was wilder, a street fighter. Because I was getting bad grades and Mike was doing well, I had an inferiority complex. I felt I had to prove myself, so I was a bit of a bully. Everybody told me to calm down. I used to worry about being perceived as stupid. My parents pushed me. Why can't you be like your brother? He gets A's, they told me. That made me angry and I would rebel. Mike was getting A's and I wasn't. When the brother sat down in the evening to do homework, Ray sought help, but he said Mike never had the patience to help me. Under academic pressure and the constant comparison to his older brother, Ray did not fare the elementary grades without psychic trauma. The bond between the brothers strengthened during their teenage years when Ray surpassed Mike on the athletic field. I was into all sports, wrestling, football, baseball, and I was doing very well. The competitive state between Mike and I eased as I made my mark in sports. Mike wasn't very interested in school sports at that time. He was becoming active in bodybuilding. He spurned team sports, and in turn, my father spurned him. Our father wanted us to be football heroes, not bodybuilders. Ray followed Mike into bodybuilding, but not without a twinge of hesitation. I entered the AAU Teenage Mr. America in 1971 with Mike, but I felt inadequate because he was so far ahead of me at that time. In the summer between grades 11 and 12, Ray discovered reading, and he abandoned team sports. It was clearly his first move toward independence. The day after Ray graduated from high school, he headed east to Washington, D.C. to live with Mike, fresh out of the Air Force. For 2 months, Ray worked in the central supply of a hospital, training in the evenings with Mike, who was a college student. Then one day, I wanted to be a mountain man, so I enrolled in college at Colorado, said Ray. That's where I started to run into difficulties. I wasn't training or playing any sports. I was drinking and partying, but through it all, I was a loner. Before long, I couldn't face my lifestyle. I had lost my physique. My self-esteem plummeted. If it's true that most men are driven to the desire to be muscularly big by physical insecurity, indeed Charles Atlas staked his fortune on that very premise, imagine then what it means to have been there and then lost it. Ray's atrophy led to sunken spirits, only to be buoyed when a former training partner from back east visited him in Colorado. My friend talked me into going for a workout, said Ray. We really hit the weights and I got so psyched up I haven't stopped lifting since. After college, Ray returned to Washington, entered competitions, and people noticed him. There's Ray Menser, Mike's brother, was the talk in the audience. Every reference to Ray's existence seemed to be qualified with mention of Mike, who was cultivating fame as a Mr. America winner. Ray was living in the shadow of his brother's success. Mike had moved out to L.A. and was becoming very well known through Joe and the magazine, said Ray. We are each fighting for our own niche or independence in bodybuilding. At this stage, I thought our rivalry hurt us. I felt I couldn't make a name of my own without being categorized with Mike. Ray persisted in his training, and despite of the anxiety, there was only room in the sport for one Menser. After narrowly losing the tall class at the 1977 AFAB Mr. America contest to Pete Kremkowski, Ray won the Mr. USA. Then in the summer of 1978, he came to Los Angeles for the World Team Challenge match in the best shape of his life. He placed second behind Mike in the heavyweight class. It was apparent at this contest that the gap between Mike and Ray had closed. There are definitely some poses I can beat him in now, said Ray. Mike has small hips, which makes his vacuum shots look great, but I beat him in the back. For as much as people say we have similar physiques, actually body per body part, we're totally different. Our legs aren't similar. Our arms are different. When Ray moved to Los Angeles last January, any rivalry, imagined or real, between Mike and him disappeared, at least temporarily. The brothers have been training together for nearly 2 months, providing encouragement for each other. Will it last? Why not, said Ray. We're mature individuals, and each of us has his goals. We're both going to train hard for a contest, whether or not we're training together. I'm helping him, and he's helping me. But my drives and my desires are mine only, and not Mike Mencer's. I'm not following in his footsteps. I have to get what I want on my own. Both of us know that we'll compete soon and that only one of us can win. But we're prepared for that because any athlete should know that if he's going to enter a competition, losing is always a possibility. Both Ray and Mike admit their relationship has never been more peaceful. Together, they purchased a ping pong table upon which they played games lasting 2 or 3 hours, all for the purpose of burning calories. Mike gets frustrated because I'm better at ping pong, laughs Ray. The competition isn't limited to the ping pong table. It's blossomed into a full-scale war during training sessions. Roy's trying to outdo the other in strength and reps, says Ray. He beats me in the arms, and that pisses me off, but I beat him in shoulder presses and legs. Everything else we're about even. I did 3 reps with 365 on the universal press. Mike can only do 3 with 335 in that movement. I'll see him do 255 pounds in the cable rows, and I know I've got to do 20 more pounds just to destroy his mind. Roy believes the family unit is what has made the American society work, but he fears the family isn't what it used to be. People are becoming too individualistic, he said. He won't let the same happen with Mike and him. Even if we're going for the same title, I don't see why we can't train together and be friends. One of us will lose and one of us will win, but that shouldn't ruin us as brothers. It should only help us. I try to be as objective as possible, but blood wins over if Mike gets in trouble. I'd be the first to help. I think competition between Mike and I will definitely stimulate and even inspire the rest of the bodybuilding world. I think both of us can equal and maybe even surpass the physique of Arnold because genetically we're better. Arnold got where he is through the will to power. We have the will to power too. All right. So that was in 1978. And of course, Mike went on to win the Mr. Universe that year in 1978 in Acapulco, getting the first or one of the first 300 scores in bodybuilding history. And the following year, Ray Mencer won the AAU Mr. America overall, and Mike went on to take second place at the Mr. Olympia to Frank Zane in his first Mr. Olympia. And Ray went on and took second at the Mr. Universe to Joseph Wilkosch. So those were some great years for the Mencer brothers. All right, so that is it for our broadcast this week. Next week, we'll have a couple more articles when we have part 2 of our interview with Jack Neary. You guys are going to love it. We're going to talk about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, where Jack was actually there, and he wrote one of the defining contest articles about the 1980 Olympia that a lot of people refer to when they talk about that contest now over 40 years later. All right, that's it for our show. Thanks again for joining us. Train hard. Stay safe out there, guys. And we'll see you next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.